right. We'll go ahead and get started with the next session. Thank you so much for attending. And this is, you know, kind of falls under that rubric of the business part of the meeting where we talk about things that are more generally appealing as an industry of healthcare and not specifically about disease entities within healthcare. And so this one is really kind of fascinating because we're talking about the current global economic crisis and what we would call the healthcare recession. And I, as you know, am not good at many things, and there's many things I'm not. And certainly one of the things I'm not is a global economist or a titan of industry, right? Like I'm really just a guy in kind of a mid-sized children's hospital who is, as many of you, really a victim of the healthcare recession as much as a solver of the healthcare recession. Well, we can talk a little bit about, you know, where we are, what we think as a group. We did send out a survey that will present some of those data in a little bit about what the aerodigestive community that filled out the survey thinks about the current condition of aerodigestive care with the United States bias, admittedly. And then we'll just kind of have some time for discussion at the end, thinking about some key themes. And I highly, highly encourage audience participation. I'm going to call down Matt Bromwich, who's a good friend of mine, to come and sure, why not? And sit. And from a CME standpoint, Matt and Sarah Walters, who is a genius that I used to work with, and now she heads up a much larger company doing, you know, kind of, well, she'll tell you what she does in a second, but she's going to know a lot about staffing and the workforce coming out of the student space into healthcare industries. And I think, if nothing else, just to kind of spur discussion, it'll be fruitful, but please feel free to jump in. So my name is Christopher Wooten, and in the Internet of Things is Mark Gerber calling in from Phoenix.
Hi, all. Thank you for the program committee for allowing us to put this together. I'm not saying we're going to be a lot of, we're not going to have a lot of uplifting information here, but it will be very interesting and hopefully a little provocative for some conversation.
Yeah, one more thing to say too, on your sheet of paper, the math doesn't quite add up. So I think it has us going to 3:15 and also breaking at 3. So I think 3 o'clock is the end point, but if things are just so captivating, I'll leave that up to you as to whether or not you want coffee or to converse.
Just gonna bring his volume down.
Okay, great. That works. Awesome. Well, that's us. And, you know, so, you know, what is the condition of the global economy right now? We don't have to go too far in any direction within media or own observations to realize that this is a difficult time. Obviously, the world always, in many parts of the world, can be characterized as having economic crisis. But I think many would agree that since 2019, there's been dramatic and disruptive changes that have been negative in their impacts. And so from the continued shadow of the pandemic in which we live to the environmental crisis that really is affecting the quality and quantity of life of individuals across the globe, to things like the energy crisis in China or the massive real estate collapse, which is occurring there to the extent that the IMF is substantially downgrading global economic growth just because of that one sector alone, because of how much tied in with raw materials and the production and consumption of goods, technological innovations and what have you in that country. We have really a global experience with inflation, and it's an inflation experience that we have not had in the United States in quite some time, where the prices are up and the purchasing power of the consumer is not meeting that price increase. And so it's creating great difficulties. That also makes the cost of capital higher. And so entities that would have ramped up temporarily during the pandemic to build and expand facilities to deal with populations of care in need, now find it hard to get the capital to build a bricks and mortar hospital or our supply chain. In our long and very global supply chain may find it difficult to build the factories or to the processing facilities or the distribution warehouses because of just the high cost of capital at this time. And then there's finally wars. And a lot of this is something that produces very visceral responses in us, thinking about the Israel-Hamas war or the Russo-Ukrainian war, and thinking about, gosh, if Iran becomes more involved and if Syria becomes drawn into this, how could we see this becoming a global conflict? And there's so much emotion and concern around that. But you also think about even just sort of adjacent, well, what is China think about and how does it participate in Russia's conflict? How does Poland factor into what's going on nearby, or Egypt? And all these countries that I mentioned actually have a real impact in the way we in this hemisphere care for children in need because of the global nature of the supply chain. So going forward, talking a little bit about how recessions in this very catastrophic landscape can form more locally, and this will be at a story of how recessions form anywhere, although we'll start by focusing a little bit on the United States healthier economy. And in reality, there are sort of three factors. You can jump into the wheel at any point, and there could be dollars or quantities of currency not being spent. Therefore, businesses that are leaning on that consumer spending make less profit. Therefore, they lay off workers. Therefore, workers have less money, and so forth. But the healthcare industry in the United States is particularly interesting. While other industries have relatively rebounded from the pandemic levels and back to similar to pre-pandemic performance, now, the healthcare industry, interestingly, had to stay in business and do a very expensive kind of care. We built atypical hospital units to expand care. We sourced and supplied and stocked up on expensive PPE from vendors we're not normally dealing with. And we saw, reimbursements for that nonetheless fall during that time frame. And in fact, by the close of the fiscal year of 22, 33% of U.S. hospitals were operating with a negative margin. So certainly the experience of how that plays into the healthcare recession is really points to us as being a unique industry here in healthcare. Mark's going to talk a little bit more about that.
All right. Well, we'll jump in and we'll be a little U.S. centric here with some of the data. The group, the Commonwealth Fund, laid out a lot of good information. And as you can see by this chart here, that 17.8% of the U.S. GDP is spent on healthcare as compared to the OECD average, which is an average of 32 established countries from around the world, this Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development. So 38 countries, excuse me. And in 2021, they looked at the annual healthcare expenditure was over $4.2 trillion. And CMS is estimating that we're going to have ongoing growth in healthcare expenditures to exceed $7.1 trillion by the end of 2031. So we are not slowing down in our rate of healthcare expenditure by what's going on right now. And I promise I'm not making political statements, just these are the factual bits of information. This is an interesting little index that I came across, which is the Milliman Index. It actually looks at insurance claims to estimate the expected total annual expenditure or the cost for a hypothetical family. And that includes this is an insured family, and you're looking at both the employer and the employee costs for a family of four. That includes two young children. And you can see it's climbing from 2021 to 2022 to 2023 with a 5.6% increase in this past year up to $31,000 in 2023. Go ahead, next slide. And of course, if we compare ourselves to other industrialized countries, we are the only one that does not have some form of universal health care. So 38% of our families are covered by government insurance, 62% by employer health care. I don't know the right answer. But we certainly are an outlier there. Then let's talk about the outcome. So what's the outcome of all these dollars that are going in? And you can see our U.S. life expectancy at birth is 3 years lower than the OECD average. And this in the red circle is our U.S. Average going down. We can go ahead and go to the next slide. We'll go through these pretty quickly. Our avoidable deaths are much higher in the U.S. than the average. We can keep going. Let's talk about a little bit about what else is going on in terms of our workforce change. You can see here in 2020, we had a huge dip in our workforce secondary to the pandemic, right? And unfortunately, what's occurred is we've not really been able to jump back up. That gap has continued. So as of January 2023, the healthcare employment increased to over 16 million. That's a new high as compared to the pre-pandemic levels. But there's, if you compare it to where we were expected to be, it's still a huge gap of 760,000 jobs below where we should be. So this is what you and I are all feeling. We're all feeling this gap in employment that we've not been able to recover from. Go ahead, next slide. Now, what are some of the causes? You know, there's a multitude, right? Between stress, burnout, the aging workforce, a limited talent pipeline. I'm excited to hear from our other speakers about a little bit about where we think that we can change. But right now, it's a very limited talent pipeline, both in the number of training slots, the number of teaching faculty, the number of potential trainees. And then when you look at the healthcare sector, limited compensation is compared to the degree, the high level of job demands, or the demands, the high demands that are being placed on the healthcare worker at all levels, as compared to the compensation they can get in other sectors.
Great. Well, thank you so much, Mark, for that overview. Who here thinks their job is stressful enough that they should be paid more? I think that was universal. We'll get to a survey in a second, but I think that one would also be a good one to ask. Everybody raise your hand, Mark. So let's talk a little bit about also some of the other things. So, you know, 50% of hospital expenditures is actually on paying their employees. About 30% goes into supply chain. And supply chain is something that when we ask our little survey, and we'll find in a second, we all find very disrupted since the pandemic. So how does the supply chain work? I mean, there's an identification of resources that healthcare providers in whatever ultimate purchasing country or purchasing entity need. And then, you know, you got to find vendors and distributors that are meeting the quality and quantity requirements. And there's a lot that goes into that, from where the raw materials come from and how that's processed, the cost of obtaining that material, the cost of fabrication, how we do a good job shipping and tracking and getting it to the right location at the right time. And there's regulatory concerns imposed by each nation and sometimes entities within those nation states, sometimes even healthcare providers themselves. We got to monitor the shipment of goods to those providers, and communication really typifies a robust and healthy supply chain, because we have to understand through this very multi-step process where our stuff is to be able to deliver the care that we feel is appropriate and timely and necessary at the end of the line as the consumer of the supply chain. And from a graphical standpoint, you know, kind of pre and through pandemic, on the x-axis is time, on the y-axis, I don't know why the integers are going up and yet being down on the axis is longer delivery times. That seems a little strange to me. But at the end of the day, you can see that there's a fairly linear relationship hovering around that 50, whatever 50 is, whatever kinds of units that is, before the pandemic, and really a lot of convergence in both worldwide, the blue line, in advanced economies, the yellow line, probably a lot of the nations you were just referring to, Mark, and in emerging economies, which is in sort of the orange-red line. And most places were able to get the stuff that they feel like they needed to deliver the care they felt like they needed to deliver in a fairly predictable way until the disruption of the pandemic. And once that happened, we can see how the world recovery is actually been a little bit more quick than the recovery for advanced economies who consume different levels of specific kind of healthcare products and have specific supply chain demands. And probably, frankly, in the United States, do a lot of healthcare, right? We just learned that it's such a huge part of our economy, and we got to be one of the, you know, the largest consumers. And therefore we're going to have this outsized experience when the supply chain is disrupted. A McKinsey report had indicated that up to 40% of, for example, U.S. healthcare providers or suppliers were not recovered in their supply chain needs within 3 months of the pandemic. So it took a long time. The cost increase actually to do the supply chain recovery was about a 440% higher cost to do supply chain right after the pandemic compared to before. And of course, if this is 30% of your hospital's sort of operating revenue, that's a big deal. it wasn't symmetrically experienced across all aspects of healthcare. So certainly intensive care unit medical supplies, respiratory care medical supplies, and the cost per patient related to those were some of the bigger areas that saw an increase in supply chain costs pre and post pandemic. And this, you know, kind of headwinds is really not resolving. It actually continues to evolve. I did this slide, and if you can imagine, these are little boats going into a headwind. They're unfortunately bubbles or kind of circles, but it would be cool if they were boats. Because really it's tough, right? And we're slowly blowing into more and more difficult times. So, you know, we mentioned wars and weird alliances and countries that other countries don't trust, and that skepticism around cooperation is felt to be about 60% of the limitation of doing better globally with supply chain by a KPMG report. The fact that the supply chain is increasingly existing as a necessarily visible and interconnected entity with a technology, you know, kind of backbone, cyber criminals are ramping up their activity in this space. Material access is in turmoil. Again, some nations are hard to get to. When we were in the middle of the pandemic, other nations were experiencing the greatest effects of the pandemic on their labor forces at rates different from, say, the United States, or the rates different from Costa Rica or parts of our hemisphere, which affects, you know, where we can source that material. It actually led to a concept of no longer offshoring your supply chain, but the term was friendshoring or nearshoring, where you're actually saying, well, as we pivot to try to get the materials we need and to fabricate those into consumable healthcare products, maybe we need to look to people we trust a little bit more. And a lot of times those are people who are so close that if we can't do it by sea, we can do it by air. If we can't do it by air, we can do it by land. Factory equipment footprints obviously are changing as well. And one of the big things in this is actually the advent and the rise of precision medicine. So some places are even seeing maybe there's more profitability making one specific product for one specific patient as a way to innovate and to remain relevant and to remain at a much lower cost than making a lot of products for a lot of patients somewhat generically and having a huge supply chain build around that. Retail and distribution changes. Some of the biggest challenges we have right now is what you kind of call the micro warehousing, that final stage between where your particular PPE comes from at the local distributor and actually getting to your site on time. The investment of technology is obviously tremendous and necessary because a successful supply chain understands every aspect of itself and where we are in that production process. Many healthcare software companies are trying to kind of come up with a holistic one product that can manage all aspects of the supply chain. And finally, there are, you know, ESG concerns that really work in this industry as well as every industry, meaning that we should be thoughtful as healthcare providers about the global environment, about the impact of climate change on the health of individuals. And people are putting that now on companies that supply even very necessary medical entities and asking that they can show that not only their carbon footprint is minimized and their direct affected carbon footprint is minimized, but also their entire supply chain, the people who are to them vendors of raw materials and the people who deliver that have minimized the carbon footprint. I did want to take a brief pause in some of my readings. This was from a KPMG article. One of the recommendations were to fast track your data management policies and capabilities and upskill your teams to make the most of technology capability for insights-led decision-making. If anybody, I would buy them a cup of coffee if they'd like to interpret what that means. And I'm sure I'm probably guilty of some jargon myself, but that's a whole nother level. So on to the next and perhaps more interesting phase of this is we actually asked y'all what you think about the supply chain, what you think about the access you have to operating rooms, what you think about the robust health of your aerodigestive teams and what have you. So we put together a survey, Aerodigestive Care in a Healthcare Recession, and we got 40 responses. Pardon probably our delayed rollout through the Aerodigestive Society. We leaned early on another group another distribution list, but we got 40 responses, mostly from physicians and unfortunately exclusively in the United States. These were people who participated in aerodigestive teams by and large. And so I think it's a salient response. And as you might expect, most of these were in academic medical centers. Mark's going to talk about the phase one information. I think you'll find this interesting.
All right. Since now this is going to be new to me because we've doubled our responses. So it seems to be staying true thus far. So the first question was, have you had to use substitute products like suction connectors, specimen collection devices, ear tube, biopsy force, ear tubes, forceps, and were those things that you needed to switch to found to be inferior to what you previously had access to before the supply chain issues? And as you can see here, most respondents were in the strongly agree category or agree categories, as it's been an issue that we've all dealt with. And I put this in the category of death by a thousand clicks. This can certainly wear on people's health and wellness, as well as sometimes can actually affect the outcome of a procedure. But by and large, this is just affecting how we are feeling as we're going through the days. Have you had to use substitute endoscopes or had major institutional process changes regarding endoscopes? This actually leans in the opposite direction, where most have said that it hasn't changed things. Maybe in my role, I've found the opposite effect, that there's been a lot of changes from processing and the push towards disposables, which we talked, Chris talked about a little bit with the environmental impact of what we are doing. And I have seen a lot of push going in certain directions. So I was certainly on the positive side of this. So it was interesting. We can talk more if people have comments about what's been effective for them or how they've been affected in terms of that. So have you had to change tracheostomy vendors or use substitute trach tubes, not your first choice substitutions, but something off the wall during the pandemic and thereafter? We see this is a strongly agree because it's been a huge issue for a long time, as we all have seen. So no surprise in that answer. Move forward. Have you had to change trach tube sterilization processes for how families are using and reusing trachs at home? And has that carried over into your institution? And again, in a similar fashion, because of the short supply of trachs, we've all had to deal with this. So no surprise there. Has there been a decline in tracheostomy tube quality or the number of tubes issued per month to the different patients? And again, it's on the same vein, so no surprises there. Has there been a decline in institutional willingness to support charity care or global health with uninsured operations or hospital-sponsored global health outreach? And a lot of places were fairly neutral on this, Dr. Rutan may weigh in that as we have seen some institutions with a long storied history of outreach have pulled back a little bit. It can be neutral for many, but it may be affecting a smaller number a lot.
Yeah, Mark and I definitely had our pet questions. This was sort of one of mine, which is, I think Vanderbilt University Medical Center does a good job trying to be lean, and as such, you know, maintained in the black through the pandemic. But as a consequence, some of these kinds of things, which are so wonderful and kind of special to healthcare providers, has been hard to get funded. You know, especially when you're thinking about, for example, an airway reconstruction, where in a risk stratification mindset, you can't always predict how that outcome is going to go, how cheap that's going to be, how many times you're going to need to return to the operating room for a surveillance or a maintenance kind of, you know, change of course operation. At least you certainly can't with mine, right? And so at the end of the day, we don't know how much this is going to cost exactly. And it's been challenging to get people to pay for it.
Have we noted a decline in the number of MD FTEs in your aerodigestive teams or a replacement of more experienced MD FTEs with less experienced MD FTEs, sort of thinking through whether it's from attrition, retirement, moving on, less interested in aerodigestive and more interested in other revenue generating areas of the field. And you can see here, there's not been a lot of change, which is actually nice to see. Is there a noted decline in our, I'm sorry, losing the top of that in the screen.
Oh, yeah. Sorry. I don't know how to manage that little pop-up. I apologize. Noted a decline in APE FTEs. Same question, but really pertaining to APPs. And again, FTEs, for those who are not used to that term, is full-term equivalent. It just basically means not full-time equivalent. It just basically means, you know, aerodigestive care may not be the only thing that Mark does if he's 30% in aerodigestive care. Has he stepped back to, 10% for some reason?
Right. And it looks like at this point, there has not been a lot of change, which is really nice to see. All over the place, right? We have some that strongly agree. So those that are affected and have had a loss of established healthcare providers, practitioners, but some it's been not affecting. Has there been a noted decline at the speech therapy level or occupational therapy level in terms of their FTEs contributing to the aerodigestive teams, or have you needed to have a replacement from more experienced to less experienced full-time equivalents? And again, here it's a little bit more all over the place. So if you go from your MDs to your APPs to your speech and occupational therapists, we are seeing a higher trend in the numbers, looking at there's more agree. But still, fortunately, many programs do not seem to have been all that affected by what's happened in the last few years. So that's a wonderful, it can be reaffirming that you've got a strong program with people that are strongly committed, or you've just been lucky and people haven't changed over. Similar from a standpoint of the nursing and administrative or coordinator roles, where has that been? And you can see the trend continues where there's a spread out. We're seeing more people agreeing, but still a fair number have not had any change. So I think it is a problem, but it's spread out. Has there been a noted objective measures of increased patient complexity within your hospitals? What's your case mix index looking like? What's your length of stay for these patients? Do you have higher impact scores on health-related quality of life measures? And like most tertiary children's hospitals, we're seeing a high degree of complexity, high severity of the case mix index. So that's as expected there. Next. Have you noted a change in the number of aerodigestive programs in your region? Have any closed or effectively closed since the start of the pandemic? And that was a little bit more on the negative, right? So now, has there been growth of programs during that same time frame? And it looks like we've actually seen some additions to the system more than we've seen subtractions. So that's actually wonderful to see that. Have you noted an increased interest in doing aerodigestive research at your institution? And we were very pleased to see that there's a lot of agreement. So a fair number of programs have had an increase. And if not an increase, I think that neutral sort of speaks to being that it stayed the same. We've been interested, we're staying interested. Have you witnessed an increase in institutional interest in supporting the multidisciplinary care that's occurring at the hospital? And it's nice to see that there's a fair amount of an agreement, very little disagreement where it's actually subtracting. Have you seen an increase in learners, medical students, residents, fellows pursuing careers in aerodigestive care? That seems like it stayed fairly neutral, with just a few that are in disagreement and a few that are in agreement that it's actually growing. All right. Dr. Wooten, it's up to you for the binary questions.
Okay. I was going to try to get the more remote mic to work so I could get out of the way, but yes, thank you. So a few questions were also not rated by a Likert scale, but were instead binary. This is an interesting one. So at Vanderbilt, all the, screensavers on all of our, clinical workstations really scroll through a lot of information, a lot of messages, things about, maintaining culture and things like that. But one of the things that's been really trending lately and in placards and signs throughout the hospital has been this kind of idea of, you know, we, you know, everybody's welcome here, but not all behavior is welcome here. And we have this concept of violence of patients towards healthcare providers, which is sort of being advertised in the background. This was endorsed by a slight majority, I guess about a 60-40 split of the people who filled out this survey, saying they have seen, you know, a more violent kind of workplace with patients towards healthcare workers. One, a little bit more pertaining to some of the data I presented earlier with the increasing cost of doing this care through and post-pandemic, is that area hospitals have closed or stopped seeing children to the extent that your hospital is becoming, you know, the place where these go, that you're absorbing these patients. In a Medicare dollars, you know, kind of standpoint, they were getting about 2.9% increase in inpatient revenue payments from Medicare. But the cost of doing care was, you know, 6.5% higher. And so the operating margin really kind of coming through pandemic about 2022 was down 3.8%. So higher cost of care, not exceeding the increase in reimbursements. On the pediatric side, obviously, we don't deal in Medicare. We frequently deal in Medicaid in the United States. That already is not a terribly lucrative business. And if you're talking about Medicaid at an ambulatory surgery center that is not actually a hospital licensed ambulatory surgery center, but it's a freestanding ambulatory surgery center, the margins enjoyed for that care is actually a lot less. Pediatric care that requires an inpatient stay overnight, that requires an observational stay overnight, gets the exact same amount of reimbursement as if the patient had gone home the same day. And so you're occupying a bed that you could fill with an adult with a more predictable, perhaps more profitable revenue stream. And instead you have a kid sitting in there for, you know, 24.5 hours, but not, you know, two midnights waiting on them to eat and drink for something you're getting paid very little for. And so a lot of places just like, I can't keep doing this business, and they've closed. In some markets, that's looked like more the mergers and acquisitions piece, where we're going to say, well, we're going to buy that hospital, buy a little bit of adult inpatient capacity, and just roll that pediatric care back to the main institution. But in other places, this is just pure market simplification. There's less healthcare entities out there in a lot of geographies across the country. And just, you know, as an aside, why? We talked about supply chain being a big deal. This is a huge deal, right? We all know this. This is workforce and contract labor expense. And so before the pandemic, many hospitals engaged what we call traveling nurses. After the pandemic, 95% of U.S. hospitals were engaging traveling nurses. The difference in job postings, you can see there on the graph on the left, it was up tremendously through the pandemic. And the chart on the right is really one of the most grim. You can see in the blue line, the worked hours by contract labor, meaning traveling nurses, and in the red line, the paid dollars to the contract nurses. And throughout the pandemic, as the demand to keep your doors open was actually more dependent on your ability to supply some nurse to that bed, and you turned to contract labor as a solution for that, some of these companies in the fourth quarter of 2021 alone posted $1.1 billion in revenue supplied in contract labor. So this was a huge gouge. And again, 50% of healthcare entities, 50% of hospitals' money in terms of cost goes to paying their employees. So when you're having to pay somebody so much more just to staff these beds, this is one of several reasons 33% were in a negative operating margin, really kind of coming out after the Omicron variant, for example. The provider relief fund disappeared after the Alpha variant in the United States. And so a lot of the second phase COVID stuff wasn't really well compensated by government relief, or wasn't propped up by government relief. Over half of the COVID hospitalizations still occurred in those later variants without the federal dollars coming in as well. So it's been a really tough time. Oh, by the way, the cost of drugs is up 28% as well. So next question, experience an unusual shortage of hospital beds, limited your ability to provide care for air digestive patient. There's a trend through all these. Most people felt like they had an unusual shortage of beds. Most people felt like they had an unusual shortage of operating room time. Most people felt like they had an unusual shortage of operating room or procedure room staff to do this care. Institutional loss of the kind of key physician components, though, was not endorsed by a majority of people. 20% of people, 20% of your pediatric anesthesiologists walking out the door. That did happen to us. We have rebuilt, but that was obviously very disruptive to our productivity. Thankfully, it didn't happen to a majority of the respondents. Likewise, loss of nurse anesthetists, or people who are extending anesthesiologists in the operating room. was not as commonly reported. Gastroenterologists are very happy on their teams. Pulmonologists, identically so. ENTs, even more. Institutional loss of pediatric speech pathologists, this was a little bit more of a vulnerable population. We saw that reported elsewhere in the other section of the survey. There was a little bit more egress of this group. And so, kind of in summary, it seems like aerodigestive teams themselves are acting robustly. They seem to be staying intact. And yet they feel like they're under-resourced from a supply chain standpoint. They feel like they're under-resourced from an operating room, an operating staff, a hospital bed standpoint. And we feel like that's impacted patient care in several ways. We identified one really as the trach space, but probably there's other spaces that we could talk about where we feel like we were at times risking inferior care to that which was given before the pandemic. So this is the audience participation part. And whenever I push this button, or maybe it is working now. We got a microphone. I've got some esteemed colleagues up here just so I don't feel so lonely talking about stuff I don't understand and merely experience as a victim. But series of questions are going to be really, how do we move forward with complex coordinated pediatric healthcare? And at the bottom, we're going to ask the question, right? So what is the role for recruitment, education, retention? Does anybody want to ask a question, want to have some commentary? There's no judgment in this room. Yes.
I do this so people can hear you.
We can swap out. We have another.
It's working like in and out. The battery's low. I'm Melissa Brooks Peterson from Children's Hospital, Colorado. I just wanted to point out that all is not gloom and doom with what we've learned through COVID. As hard as it's been with supply chain issues, we've had, I sit on a couple other boards and we have dealt with all of the same things that were shared, but also have recognized two distinct silver linings. Number one, we have robustly increased, and I think to a very effective degree, video visits with our patients. We in, here in Denver have, you know, a 7-8 state region that patients come from hundreds miles away, and COVID forced us to get savvy with a lot of video visits. And I think that that's going to be a lasting silver lining. The other silver lining we've can take from the last few years is our video meeting status. Having planned a lot of meetings, we never did hybrid virtual and live component. And now we know from COVID that it is the way to increase attendance and participation for people who either can't get travel from their institutions or don't come from an institution where travel is supported or can't get clinical time away to do that. So just wanted to point out to even though the economy is struggling, two silver linings we've actively taken from the last few years.
Yeah, thanks, Melissa. Those are fantastic comments and very true. And honestly, not probably in our immediate kind of framework of recruitment, education, retention. I love, yeah, the successful use of technology and really gathering together through that. Sarah, would you like to talk a little bit about workforce as you understand it going forward?
Sure. So I'm the executive director for HOSA Future Health Professionals. We're a current technical student organization that work within the health science education sector. We have about 270,000 members globally here in the U.S. and about 6 international territories. And I would say, to echo that comment, it's not all gloom and doom. We're actually seeing a steady increase of students that are interested in entering the health professions and the health careers. Some of it is getting into those admission slots. You know, I would say from education and recruitment, you know, I go back to that survey slide of what learners are interested in aerodigestive care and what can we do to bring greater attention to aerodigestive in multidisciplinary care throughout all of the subspecialties. There was a recent report released by the National Academy of Sciences that talked about career decision-making for pediatric subspecialists and where does that start? And that starts in the pre-post-secondary space. So the more that we have solutions to talk about What are the areas of specialization? How can we open up career experiences and observations that really went away during the pandemic? And as those start to come back and bringing them in, there's also a big push, by at least in the US, for the Department of Education to have industry ready credentials upon high school graduation. So how do we bring those students in as direct entry workers? That can happen, but then also convert them, many of them, to higher level occupations that are then going to be our next colleagues, teammates, and care providers.
Oh, well, that's fantastic insight. And what did you say by, you said post-secondary, so a lot of that differentiation is coming right after?
So actually pre-post-secondary, pre-college, many of the National American Associations are actually wanting to go to middle and elementary school in terms of that first career exploration, with a lot of that initial identification being in the middle or mid-elementary, when they start to lean and make some of those career decisions and interest. And then some of the career-ready high schools, you're actually picking a track and saying, I want to learn about business, I want to learn about healthcare, and making that decision before you're entering into the high school. We think about, there are some in Texas that are even health professions high schools that are embedded within hospitals and organizations or within schools of medicine that do a lot of that early training, but at a very, very young age.
That's fantastic. That's great ideas. You know, next question here, Mark, what do you got for us?
In terms of revenue attribution, right? How are we going to protect our current, you know, what we're doing in terms of trying to manage the things that may not be the money winners, but are critically important to what we are trying to coordinate for and to obtain by putting this multidisciplinary care unit, the aerodigestive care that we provide together. And I think that I agree, this is not all doom and gloom. Many of our institutions are recognizing the contribution that the multidisciplinary care centers are providing. They are helping us with gaining support, both from a research and administrative perspective. So keeping that process moving forward is huge, and not taking our foot off the gas. Putting these types of programs together, showing what the aerodigestive teams have been able to do, continuing to publish the outcomes, both from a medical perspective, as well as continuing to show the financial success of our multidisciplinary teams, is huge.
Yeah, and some of this, you know, goes back to a conversation, you know, I remember having with Mike Rutter some time ago, I guess probably maybe 2019, 2020, where you're still, and it was kind of refreshing in some ways because, you know, he's at a great and successful institution that has really put their international mark on pediatric, you know, complex care in the airway space. And yet still, how do you argue to hospital administrators that the stuff you're doing right here in the picture, you know, is of tremendous economic value as it rolls and snowballs through to inpatient activities, to, you know, post inpatient activities, to continued contact with the health system. So it's a question of revenue attribution. Yes, Chris Hartner.
Thanks. Just a comment. I mean, I'd be interested in over the experience both nationally and now abroad, but for certainly with regards to coordinated patient pediatric healthcare, when you talk about outcomes and you talk, one of the things that's been extremely helpful for us with navigating our healthcare space, as it's you who are an acronym, as we've changed from Mass General to Mass to Partners to Mass General Brigham, and the names keep changing, is that reflection of a number one, patient experience, and number two, access to care across low communities that have problems with access. That one of the issues with the narrow digestive clinic is that it's a point of entry for many people to access across different communities. And the more that you have a communication with your administrators, for us at least, that's been very helpful. Mm-hmm. And the other issue is this context of how do you express the patient's experience in a way that's understandable, that we really, you know, it's we who are frustrated in healthcare, one of the satisfied parts is that we're treating a child and not a trachea and not a lung, but it's also helpful for the parents to be treated as much that way as well. And the more we can reflect that to our administrators, the more their ears seem to be open.
With thin margins, do administrators listen to patient experiences or do they listen to inpatient revenues, or what do you think? Well, with the thin margins of today, do administrators obviously don't want bad press, but is patient satisfaction as impressive to them when they're getting held over a barrel by nursing contract labor costs, or is it really more still, I need to see more heart transplants and more, you know, brain surgeries, and I'm glad you guys are doing good work.
Every institution is different, but I would say that, you know, what I've certainly seen over the last 20 years is more and more of the trainees, as you do, get an experience in the language of medicine and not treat your administrators as adversarial as best you can, but as partners, not in crime, but in healthcare.
Yeah.
And I would say number one. And the other thing is just sort of think outside of the boxes, per se. One of the things different institutions have different ways. We have started, I run the trials group for our institution. We've started to fund faculty time, not just for grants that are funded, but grants that are written up to a certain standard to pay for time. Because I think one of the things that we realize that time is our greatest currency, not mm-hmm. other currencies. So there are ways outside the box, perhaps.
I want to ask one quick question maybe of the group, like our show of hands. So how many in attendance at their institution have you started billing for EMR-related medical care, like where you're providing care through the EMR without any other visit, as long as it's documented appropriately? Is this something that's been done at your institution? Yeah, I imagine it's coming. Interesting to me is, like, when we talk about it, they said since in the last 2 years, our EMR utilization, our messaging through the patient portal has increased 270% in 2 years. And it's very palpable. And it's a lot of an expectation of immediate response. It's sort of like having a text conversation with 4,000 family members at, you know, on a day-to-day basis with that kind of expectation of response. And so this requires, though, like a separate documentation in order to be able to bill for a subset of that care, which isn't motivating for me. Your risk potential, like a negative patient interaction, to do extra work to capture a tiny bit of revenue, which someone else wants, hoping that in the big picture, it might change the culture of healthcare utilization a bit or impact it. But I don't know if there's any comments about this.
Yeah. So I would say, actually, you know, the funny thing is you say our institution points to your institution and they say, well, you know, Mayo's doing so, maybe we got to figure out how to do this. But I think, you know, maybe this might even lead us into the next panel that we get onto, like as people start talking about AI sort of coming as a way to address this. But you look at this whole big sort of picture, I think it's just fascinating how every institution, while there's so many things that are similar, there's so much going on together. At the end, we're all kind of fighting our own way and fighting these own battles. It's very interesting to see as it plays out.
Thank you so much for this discussion. I just wanted in 2 seconds, you talked about gift of time or the commodity of time. Matt, would you just briefly mention the role that you're in now in Ottawa on innovation? And I think this is one of these guys that, I'm like, why does this bottle crinkle so much when I hold it? I wish it had more elasticity, but yet, you know, maintain the same amount of plastic content. And Matt would have a prototype by the end of the day. I've noticed that, you know, that kind of thing.
Thanks, Chris. Anyway. So my role at our hospital is in innovation, which is a buzzword, I suppose, and I want to define it very briefly, but it's many types of innovation. So if you take what hospitals do when they go from 2-ply toilet paper to 3-ply toilet paper, you could call that an innovation, and it maybe it is, but they have all the tools necessary to do that already, and they don't need our help or our involvement, which makes it overly complicated. I would just say that if there's things that require a new business model, so when you're going to capital purchase to subscription, kind of blew up the hospital's head. They're like, we're not sure we can do that. We don't have that in a budget. Or maybe it's changing the technology and that's hard to wrap their head around. Or maybe it's changing the context, like where it is. So the surgical safety checklist started in the airline industry, yet we all do it now. And you'd think, well, that's an obvious change. But I would call that the type of innovation that happens in hospitals that's hard for them to do without help. So routine innovation, they do all the time, great. If it requires context, technology, or business model change, they probably need help. And if you try and do more than one of those at the same time, it's impossible. Quick example, Spotify. Netflix. You think Netflix is an online subscription streaming service, but it didn't start that way. They mailed you DVDs, right? For 8 years, they mailed you DVDs by subscription before they started doing the online streaming. And had they done both at once, it probably wouldn't have worked because you can't do too much change. Just like changing all your fish tank water at the same time, your fish die. So too much change is bad. But the nice things, as mentioned by the lady in pink, is that the pandemic gave us a really good advantage to go from austerity, where people say, I don't want to try new things, to crisis, where all of a sudden everything's on the table. So sometimes those crises can unlock innovation. So anyway, happy to chat.
Awesome.
So I know that Chris talked about this a bit, but Dana Williams is asking if the panelists can share their experiences in the Aero program regarding the mechanism for staff, FTE protection, or administrative communications. It's hard.
Well, again, I feel like, you know, panelists is a loose term. I don't know, Mark, if you even heard that question, but go.
I mean, here with, and I'm with Dr. Williams at Phoenix Children's, it's an amalgam and it's a little bit messy. We haven't been successful yet in carving out all of the staff FTEs into its own cost center yet. So we are an amalgam of otolaryngology, pulmonology, gastroenterology, and the FTEs intermix. And it's a little bit messy when we try to add support. So we are looking to consolidate. So I think that question probably drives a little bit with Dr. Williams as the medical director, really struggling to, as we pull the team together, and we've had some FTE changes, we are moving through it, and really her direction has been phenomenal, but challenges are there. So hearing what other programs are doing would be a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and I guess from our institutional standpoint, just, you know, when we went into the pandemic and we decided that it wasn't safe to necessarily be at the hospital if you didn't have to be, and we're going to platoon our teams, or we're going to stop all elective operations, well, certainly everybody applied some sort of rubric to assign value to patient care. And we wanted to only do the necessary care, and we wanted to do the most urgent or emergent care. And I think, the American College of Surgeons had a guideline that you could use. Other people in other countries and other entities probably use different guidelines. But it didn't take long in the re-emergence or the re-engagement of elective or scheduled cases to realize that the aerodigestive population is an extremely needy population. Like, you're never going to, it's going to be hard for a lot of other services to compete with kind of the case mix index of aerodigestive care. The fact that it is a carefully coordinated process by excellent coordinators like Elizabeth Vaughn sitting up there, and our surgery schedulers as well, getting certain kinds of expensive professionals together at the right place at the right time and the right patient is something we don't want to routinely bump and disrupt. And so I think in some ways, the necessity of our care and the interwovenness of our care has protected us. And then I would give a shout out to the work done here at Colorado. I know Melissa's talked about it a lot, but just the idea of how healthy it is for healthcare providers to be on multidisciplinary teams like aerodigestive teams, and how much it's kind of like the one nice thing I do every week. I hope maybe there's two. But
it's because of the snacks.
Yeah, and it is the snacks. The food is tremendous. There's a homemade pimento cheese, which is second to none, and I want to shout that out too. But anyway, I'm standing between you guys and coffee. Thank you so much for your participation. Please reach out via email or chat in the hallway.
Thank you all.